Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Nina.
This is another podcast we're having today. And I was thinking that maybe we could chat about women artists in general as a subject. And on an occasion of a couple of major loan retrospective exhibitions that were organized at two sides of the globe that unfortunately we have not attended for reasons that we'll explain in a minute. But this is just a pretext to talk about maybe a place of women artists and women in art in general.
Right.
The two exhibitions that I'm referring to, one was in San Francisco called Frida. It was about Frida Kahlo. And the other one was it was an exhibition of works by Artemisia Gentileschi, an Italian artist, and that exhibition was supposed to take place in London. Both of them were put together. We had tickets to them, but unfortunately the exhibitions could not open because of the global lockdown.
Right, right. But you've written them up and they're absolutely beautiful. It's another great example of eye candy.
Well, that's your favorite term for it. I think the eye candy comes from the artists themselves. But yes, we have covered them. You know, I wrote about them as much as I could without having seen it. Maybe we should tell everybody where they can be found if someone wants to read them.
So the Food for the Soul website has been launched and our feedback on it is very positive. It's quite beautiful. Why don't you, before we dive into the women artists section, just tell people what's here and what they can find and how often they can find it.
The site itself is called Food for the Soul, for a number four. So food, number four, the soul, at .solari.com. That's the website where you can find all these articles about art. They appear about every 2 weeks, there's some new article. And they are divided into various sections. Some of it is exhibitions. Some of it is devoted entirely to women artists. We also have podcasts and videos and other goodies on that website. It's a dedicated area within the solari.com general homepage. And the goal is to bring some coverage or either movies or exhibitions or some art events now and then, from the point of view of my personal philosophy that art or entertainment or culture in general should be something that soothes people's nerves, minds, and souls. In other words, it should have some therapeutic effect, not only as something that is a pursuit of intellectual curiosity, even though that is important as well, but also for me, art is something that is important just to get away from the stress of the daily life. And I think that the art that we are covering in this podcast is particularly suitable for that, in a sense that it has been created by artists who are women, which normally should not be a factor when you create art. But the creators themselves, women, have had to overcome major obstacles to even become artists, at least in the days that or times that they have lived in.
So ever since I've known you, you have a passion for these women artists and you dig them out and you find them. Whenever we go to a museum, you say, okay, now that we've seen the Da Vinci, there's, you know, or when we saw the Degas in Paris, it was suddenly these women artists are here. Let's go here. So this is, you've had a passion for this and I want to know how it got started.
I don't think I have a passion or started with a passion for it as such, but what I have discovered throughout the years, thanks to various museums that now in the kind of 21st century where women are a little bit more recognized and celebrated than maybe in the centuries past, or let's say 20, 30 years ago, museums have started putting together exhibitions that are devoted to one single female artist. So that was the impetus in a sense that I had an opportunity to then see some art that is devoted to just one female artist. But once I have done that, I have started looking into the life stories of these artists. And each time I look at it, it is an amazement in terms of how difficult was the trajectory of their lives, how much they had to overcome just to become a painter. Obviously, the further in time the biography is, the harder it was. But that's what I find fascinating when I look at not only the output, meaning what they have created, but also what was their life story. The life stories are fascinating.
Right.
And then I want to go back again from the life story and say, well, yes, they had very complicated and difficult lives, but then look what I have achieved. When I was writing about Artemisia Gentileschi, about whom we probably should talk in a second, this is a perfect example when at some point her life story became bigger than her art, and only now we're going back and looking at those paintings and saying those paintings are amazing, even for the times that she lived in, where she was surrounded by major Baroque artists who were extremely talented.
They're breathtaking. Remember when we were in to see the last Da Vinci's Last Supper, and the leader of the tour said, look at the mural on the back wall and then turn and look at Da Vinci. And what you realize is the one on the back wall has no dimensions to it. It's very flat. Whereas Da Vinci's has, you know, you really see the auras of the different people. And you, when you look at this artist, because I still struggle to pronounce her name, it's amazing for that time how much depth there is. You know, it's almost like a Rembrandt. There's incredible depth.
Exactly. So just to explain to everybody, what are we talking about? The artist that we are referring to is called Artemisia Gentileschi. She lived in the 17th century. She was the eldest daughter of the four children that an artist in Rome, a painter in Rome called Orazio Gentileschi had. Her mother died early, so she was basically raised in a household of her father, her three younger brothers, and herself. Orazio, being a painter who was a commissioned painter who painted various frescoes in churches in Rome as papal commissions, had a successful household. He was also enough of an artist and presumably kind of ahead of his time in terms of how he treated women, that he recognized that Artemisia, of all his children, was the one who had the talent. So he wasn't forcing her to take over the household and kind of do women things once Orazio's wife and her mother has died, but he has allowed her to learn the craft of painting in his workshop. That would be a very kind of advanced thinking for a father in 17th century Italy. And we are very grateful to him for that.
Right.
This is where she came from. What has happened in her life and consequently in the way that she's portrayed or analyzed in the future centuries is that something absolutely horrible has happened to her when she was about 18 years old. She was a budding artist. She already has painted major paintings by then, so she wasn't just, you know, a little schoolgirl who didn't know how to do art. Orazio was working with a minor painter called Agostino Tassi, who was working with him on some frescoes in Rome. He hired him to be a tutor to Artemisia to teach her perspective. In those days, when you used to paint a painting that had figures and, let's say, some architectural elements and then maybe some landscape, there was a tradition that sometimes it would be a compiled work, meaning someone would specialize in painting the figures, someone else was good at the architectural elements and or perspective, and someone else would be painting the sky behind it. That was an accepted way of creating a painting, especially if it was a commissioned painting, a big religious painting for a church. So artists did specialize in some parts of painting. it wasn't an unusual thing to be hiring someone to teach her some elements let's say, architectural perspective to kind of enhance her abilities. The problem was that Mr. Tassi was not exactly a good guy. He has lied to everybody about the fact that he was actually married. One day, Artemisia was left alone with him. He probably paid off a servant because when she was crying for help, the woman servant who was supposed to help her did not come to her aid, and she got raped. She was about 18 years old. At the time, once her virginity or her youthful attractiveness was destroyed, the honorable thing for a man would be to marry her. He was pretending to be not married and was pretending that he's going to have honorable intentions, as they used to call it, and that he will marry her. That went for several months until Orazio realized that this is an empty promise, and then they discovered that also he was married and he could have never married Artemisia to make an honest woman out of her. Then Orazio and Artemisia decided to do something very unusual and go to trial, a public trial in Rome, which normally would not be the way for a father and a daughter to proceed, because obviously once you put it out in the open, that means that obviously her chances to get married and have a normal life are completely ruined. But they proceeded. They went into a trial. The trial was extremely dramatic and traumatic for Artemisia. She was tortured by having her thumbs put into screws, into vice. For a painter, it's not a very good thing to have your fingers ruined. She has not succumbed to torture. She has not changed her story. She kept saying that this is true, that she was raped. She had a humiliating medical examination. It was just a horrible experience for her altogether. Tassi was found guilty, especially after the fact that he was married came to light. But at the same time, he was a commissioned artist who was working on frescoes for the church. So his punishment was negligible. He was just basically told that he should be banished to the suburbs of Rome, which was actually never enforced. Artemisia, at the end of the trial, was kind of hastily married off to another painter, some minor painter that Orazio knew, just to preserve her honor. And then she left Rome a year later. So that's how the whole trial affair went through. The problem is that because of everything that has happened, by the time she started being a little bit fashionable in mid-20th century, I would say, the story of poor Artemisia is kind of becoming bigger than her art. And that's what I was writing in that article, that luckily there is some reverse in art history going on now, that yes, the story was very dramatic, but we should really look at her amazing art. Exactly what you're saying is that how amazing those paintings are.
Well, there's the one where she's beheading the warlord, or it's the painting of Judith who's beheading the warlord, which are quite, I mean, you know, it's funny because they're quite gruesome, but they're very, very beautiful. And and kind of very interesting the way they've done. I don't know, I love several of them. The one at the top is just so amazingly beautiful. It's and it feels so Italian.
The painting on the top that you're referring, and anybody who wants to see it, that is the main painting at the beginning of the article about Artemisia, is called La Pittura, which means the allegory of painting, and it actually is a self-portrait of Artemisia painted in London kind of later in her life. And allegory of painting is one of the themes of, let's say, Baroque paintings and later has been undertaken by other artists. But first of all, it is a self-portrait, because usually allegory of painting is painted by men. And of course, they would be just painting a model. Here she's painting herself. The interesting thing is that you don't see the painting that she's painting. It's a blank canvas because this is something that hasn't happened yet. So your eyes are immediately drawn to the person because there's nothing else to see. There's this kind of blank background otherwise. But the allegory of painting traditionally is painted with the woman whose mouth are covered with a piece of cloth or a gag, if you like, because you want to convey the meaning that the paintings do not speak. So the allegory of painting is actually mute. But this one is not like this at all. There is no gag around her mouth. You know, there's no way this woman would have painted a gag. You know, she's been already gagged enough.
Well, you can see in the picture what a strong person she was. You know, you can feel it. She's very strong.
With a very difficult life, because unlike some other, even female paintings like Sofonisba and Guizzola, about whom I have written before, which was another Italian Baroque painter, Artemisia did not have any patron, not the Pope, not any prince. There were no aristocratic or religious or royal patrons that she would have that would ensure her existence and give her steady stream of commissions. She just basically traveled from various places of Italy and had to scrounge getting commissions, which was not easy because a single woman, not a man, that has no patron, it has a very hard time to survive in 17th century Italy with all the military strife. And then she went to London to join her father, who had some commissions from a king, and she thought that maybe she found a safe haven there. You know, her father is there to help her out, and he's employed by at the royal court. But fate intervened, of course, and that royal court was the court of Charles I, unfortunately the king, who was beheaded not long after. So, of course, as far as patrons go, that she lost that opportunity as well. The king lost his head and she lost the opportunity of having a patronage. This was a very difficult life, which I find fascinating. But going back to what we were talking earlier, it is amazing to me to see that someone who has had to overcome so many difficulties still created such an incredible art that we can enjoy hundreds of years later, which stands out as exactly as you said.
It's interesting that Queen Elizabeth owns the painting now.
Well, because that painting was left in England. That painting was for the court of Charles I. It was part of his collection. He was a big art collector, and that's what the queen has inherited. It's a lot of paintings in the queen's collection are from that period, from Charles I's collection.
Four of the paintings are of Judith and the story of Judith. Do you have any idea why she was so interested in Judith, or if that was a commission?
What to me, what we are talking about is the kind of popular religious theme in many paintings in Renaissance, Baroque, even later, is a theme of Judith beheading Holofernes. Judith was in Old Testament the brave Jewish woman who was kind of delegated by her Israeli tribe to help with the invasion that was being managed by an Assyrian warlord, a general called Holofernes. She goes into Holofernes's camp, seduces him, or at least presents herself. She manages to get him drunk, and when he falls asleep, she, with her faithful servant called Abra, the two women manage to overpower Holofernes, and Judith cuts off his head. Once she has done this, Abra carries the head, and they go back from Holofernes' military camp back to her people, and she presents the heads to her tribe's elders in triumph and has saved her tribe from being destroyed by Holofernes' army. This story is often illustrated in art because since more or less medieval times, there is a kind of a theme of powerful women, kind of inspirational theme, or sometimes maybe the way to give women some kind of vindication in art. But there is this series of powerful women in art, and this is the topic, if you like, in art. Mm-hmm. I think Artemisia, and not only me, but I think a lot of art historians think that as well, that Artemisia has basically made this theme her own because this is the way for her to channel the rage that she must have felt after having been raped and humiliated. She could not attack Tassie with her own bare hands, but she could certainly paint Judith attacking Holofernes with her bare hands.
Right, right.
And that's why she painted that painting. Once she has painted the first one, the subsequent ones are probably also copies that are commissions, meaning someone has seen the original one, the one with the blue dress that is in Naples, and then they would want a similar, paint me another Judith and Holofernes kind of requests. But mm-hmm. I think that also she's also gone beyond, because if you see in further paintings, some of them, it is after the act. She has kind of moved on, and now she's kind of portraying the two women trying to escape with the head of Holofernes back to the tribe and being pursued and persecuted, which I think it's kind of an evolution of her feelings of how the women have to survive in the male dominated world. I don't want to become too much of a feminist in this interpretation, because I firmly believe that 21st century interpretations of 17th century art are a little bit skewed. It's called presentism in history in general. And I don't want to input what she thought. And this is why I wanted just to show to everybody how amazingly beautiful and interesting those paintings are, regardless whether there is an underlying dramatic history. There is a dramatic history in case of Artemisia.
Right.
But art kind of surpasses people's histories, because an artist usually would take some elements of their biography, but then they would transcend it. Otherwise, it's not called art. Otherwise, it's called a memoir, a diary, right? And that's not what she does in art.
Now, do you know what So you've done four of these. Do you know what your fifth is going to be?
Oh, no. This is something that I never know. It's just whatever inspires me. That's what art's function is, to inspire people. But I think that this is wonderful that, you know, that the museums have started, you know, kind of doing a single exhibitions devoted to female artists, because when we kind of wander around museums, yes, there would be, a work, but I don't know, Barbara Hepworth or Kara Walker, to mention some contemporary artists, but it's kind of buried in between many other artists that only when you see it kind of in an essence or concentrated, then you realize, oh, this is this interesting artist I never knew about. What I have found most fascinating when kind of reading the biographies of those 17th century artists is how many of their great paintings have been reattributed in the 20th or 21st century, meaning for centuries after they have painted something, the painting would be attributed to some minor male artist who happened to be at the court of the country that she was living in. And only after a lot of research, sometime in the 20th century or 21st century, they just look at those paintings again, and the paintings get reattributed to that female artist, which tells you something about the society of, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century societies that basically kind of have buried the poor women's work. Because, you know, if it's such a great painting, of course it had to be painted by the court painting. It couldn't have been painted by some minor woman somewhere there, right?
Right.
That I find it fascinating, that we kind of are doing archaeology on paintings that sometimes are in a canon of painting. Like there are paintings by this Italian Baroque painter called, they all have complicated names, I'm sorry. She's called Sofonisba Anguissola, so another difficult name. Sofonisba was for many years at the Spanish court in Madrid as a lady-in-waiting to Queen Isabel. The problem is that she has painted several royal portraits of the queen, of the king, of, you know, other royals there. And these are in the canon of Spanish art and historical art, because these are the portraits, official royal portraits, that are in like textbooks for children to learn at school about the royal dynasties. And then only, I think in late 20th century, these paintings got attributed to or reattributed to Sofonisba, meaning you have something that is really a very famous image, and nobody knew that it was painted by this female artist.
Wow.
That I find fascinating.
Well, I think, you know, I'm hopeful that you'll continue this series, because I think there are a lot of gems to be pulled out. I wanted to mention that when you come into the women series and you click on the women series on the Food for the Soul website, you have a picture that at the top of the sort of the homepage for the women. And it reminds me so much of, I just did a review last year of Virginia Woolf's book, A Room of Our Own. And that picture so reminds me of that book and that notion of having a room of your own. And it's so charming. And it gives that feel to the women artists of, you know, now they have a place of their own on the Food for the Soul website. So I always love coming in and looking at it. And that's from Poland.
Yeah, that painting is by Olga Boznańska, that one day maybe I'll do a story about. She's quite an interesting 19th, early 20th century painter.
Uh-huh.
But let's talk a little bit from your area of expertise about this socioeconomics of, you know, being a female artist, certainly in the centuries past, but maybe even today. Because, as we all know, there's very few female artists. It's not easy to find one. If you go through the museum, it's not easy to find one.
Right.
And obviously, there are socio-economical reasons why there is less female artists than male in museums. And as achievements of someone like Artemisia attest, it is not for the lack of talent. It's not that she was not such a good artist. So can we talk about this? Because I think you would bring a perspective of the socioeconomics of a women artist.
This reminds me very much of what it was like. You know, I was the first woman partner at a major Wall Street firm.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the pecking order worked, you would get hired with a group of associates. So maybe there'd be 10 or 20 associates in the class. And at best, only one was going to make partner. And so the competition was vicious. I mean, just absolutely vicious. And I'm sure it was the same, you know, if you look at Da Vinci in Milan or Florence, there's a limited number of sponsors and you're competing for a limited pot of commissions, right? So the competition between the men was just absolutely vicious. But the one way they could agree on delaying or deferring or easing the competition is they could all agree just to kill the woman. Because if you had to knock off a couple people every year, well, in the first year, you just get together and you knock off the women, right? So even though they competed viciously, they could collaborate on killing the woman. And it was funny because if you look at their dream, their vision of success, you know, their vision of success was the women would want them. And so the role of women was to want them, not to, you know, take away the money they needed to acquire, the status they needed to acquire so they could get the woman. So a woman was just confusing the whole thing and making things worse. And, you know, I could just tell you really amazing stories of what it was like, because it was supposed to take 12 years to become a partner at Dillon Reed, and I did it in 8. And I was the first woman partner and the first member of the board. And the competition was just, it was wild. And, you know, you had to be, you had to make up your mind, you know, I'm going to keep my eye on the prize and not worry about sort of the, you know, I'm going to play to win at the competition, whatever it was. And part of it is you just make more money for the firm than anybody else. You know, you just do a great job at the fundamentals. But one of the things you saw on Wall Street was because there were very few women at the partner and equity owner level, there were very few women putting money into art or culture. You know, the money that was pouring into the art, because Wall Street, the people at the very top of the money chain understand the power and importance of art, and they spend tremendous amounts of money on sort of engineering culture in some ways that are very positive, in some ways very negative. You know, but that money is controlled by the people who make it. And so if the women aren't making the money, they're not controlling. Now, if you look at a lot of my favorite women artists, they're all painting things. A lot of the things they paint have to do with women's world. So they have to do with the world of children and the world of women and things women think about and do. And by and large, the men just don't relate to that. Now, there are exceptions, but, you know, so I think the more you have money flowing into women who are making money, who are very interested in seeing different representations of a woman's world. I mean, it's amazing to me that this one, I know it may just be, you know, from inheriting it, but this one is owned by Queen Elizabeth. So, you know, who has, needless to say, a fantastic collection. But I think the
Queen Elizabeth collection is really not, it's inherited from Charles I, who was a major collector.
Right.
He lost his head literally at the end of it. But before he lost his head, he was a major collector who collected and commissioned major paintings. So that usually helps a royal house in any country where they have at least one aficionado of art. Like in Spain, there was Philip II, who was one of them.
Right. Well, it's very funny, as you and I go around to museums, you're fascinated by the artists and I'm fascinated by the collectors and the publishers who kind of engineered the money that made it all come together and work. So you can see our inclination. But I think, you know, what you had these women struggling in a world where the men were really the dominant energy in the competition for limited commissions, it was an extremely hard road for a man. You know, look at the stories of some of the artists, the men artists we love, and, you know, the brutal competition and fight for just economic survival that they had to live through. So you add to that the, you know, sort of being a woman and out of the flow. And so, yeah, I think it was very hard. But what is interesting is if you look at the really great ones, I always tell people you have to do what's in you to do. We all come into this world with a gift. You have to do your gift, because what you see is they triumph because they're so, you know, one, they have a gift, but two, they're dedicated to their gift. And I think if you look at, for example, if you look at the men I know who would easily buy or collect a woman's painting, they buy it not because it's by a woman or a man or not necessarily because it's about a topic a man would be more interested in than a woman, but because that gift just shines through. And when you look at these, I'm sitting here looking at the, you know, all the stories of Judith or what, I mean, the gift just shines through. And I think that's ultimately what makes a great painting, is that incredible spark of light and humanity. It's amazing.
Actually, I think you just touched upon something fascinating, because I didn't really think about it this way. But you're right that if the patrons, meaning people in money and power, no matter what age, you're actually talking about 20th and 21st century, but at any time are male, then obviously they will commission women less, and kind of like a trickle-down problem of less commissions for women. I didn't think of the socioeconomic aspect of women artists struggling, I was more thinking about the fact that, oh, well, they had to have children, they had to start families, they would sometimes not be allowed to paint after they got married. There's several biographies of women artists that are exactly like that.
Well, but here's the problem. If I'm a patron and I commission something from a woman, I'm going to take a lot of crap from the Precking Order. So I've got to really want something from that woman. I've got to really be impressed by the gift, because it's not going to help my, you know, if you look in the Pecking Order, that's going to lower my status. I'll give you a perfect example. I used to be a member of the Recess Club, which was the most prestigious luncheon club in down on Wall Street. And it was really funny when my first day at the Recess Club, I went in and you can sit at the members table. And I didn't realize, you know, I thought there had been more women. It was just when they started to take women. Anyway, I sat it down at the members table and I had my paper and I was just going to read my paper and eat lunch. And I realized everybody was looking at me, and there was a man sitting next to me who was so handsome and charming. He was in his 70s, but just unbelievably beautiful blue eyes. And he was kind of smiling. And I said, did I do something wrong? And he said, I don't know if you realize this, but you're the first woman to ever sit at the members table at the Recess Club. And it turned out he was
19th century.
Wait a minute. But it turns out he was W.E. Hutton. And so I got to meet W.E. Hutton because he was sitting next to me. It was quite charming. And it was a very interesting lunch. But anyway, so a couple lunches later, I invited, I won't use his name, but a very charming vice president who ran the associate group. I was a vice president at the time. He was a vice president. So I invited him to lunch. And we sat down and we were in the middle of lunch and he turned more and more white. You know, the blood was draining out of his face. He started to sweat profusely. I was really worried he was going to have a heart attack. And so I'll use the name Sam. I said, Sam, are you all right? And he looked at me and he was really panic stricken. I mean, he was having an anxiety attack. And he said, do you realize you're the only woman in this room? You know, it was a big dining room with lots of tables. And I said, no, Sam, actually, I hadn't realized that. And what I realized was he thought his status was going to be destroyed because he was going to be seen eating with the only woman at the Recess Club. And that would be have devastating consequences for his status in the pecking order. So if you're a man who's coming up with a big oil painting commission for a woman when all these, you know, ferocious men are competing to get it, you know, you're taking a risk. You could really, in a lot of societies, you could really get into trouble for that.
Exactly. I mean, your story is fascinating, but to transpose it into the female artist world, I think a lot of this must have happened. That they would just be that odd woman out in a group, but not the first person that came to mind when commissions were being offered, not to mention the problem of having to have a family. If they didn't choose that, then there was immediately other social problems. I wrote about a painter called Berthe Morisot, who was kind of, you know, from the very established bourgeois family in 19th century Paris. She was extremely talented. She became one of the group of the impressionist artists when they kind of broke away from the academician artists and started painting their own way.
I love her paintings. I just love her paintings.
Paintings, but when you read her biography, there are so many struggles. At some point, you know, she was being badgered by her parents into getting married because, you know, she was kind of like an old spinster and painting and not getting married. You know, being 25 and not married by that time, it was definitely being an old spinster. She did marry eventually at about age 30 to a brother of Edouard Manet, who was not only her friend, but also, you know, one of the most famous 19th century painters. Her sister, with whom she was taking classes, was very talented. There is a portrait of Berthe that is painted by Edna and her sister Edna, and she was extremely talented. But once she got married off at some respectable 19th century bourgeois guy, she had to stop painting. She was having children, she was being a housewife, and there goes the talent.
It reminds you of that great movie that just came out on Colette. I wanted to tell you, you know, the painting, I love the painting of her by her sister. And the thing I love about it is, if you look at my Dylan Reed online book, it was translated into French by Vanessa Baird, who's a Parisian. And this painting looks exactly like Vanessa. It's the spitting image of her. It's quite remarkable.
Well, also a French woman.
yeah. Beautiful French women.
Exactly. But it's interesting that you bring this perspective of a woman in a man's world, because all the women artists, no matter what century they were, they obviously were living in a world totally dominated by men. I don't have this feminist point of view of men versus women in general, but if you have the world dominated by whatever group it is very hard as an outlier to make it, and you have to be twice as good just to survive in this world. I have professionally have lived in the same kind of world, so I know exactly what you're saying. But when I look at the art, because obviously 200-300 years later, we really do not care that much what the biography was, but what stays on the canvas, so to speak. But I am fascinated by their life stories, how they kind of informed what ended up on a canvas. That's why I love this Artemisia's painting of Allegory of Painting, where she doesn't have her mouth gagged, even though every single other Allegory of Painting has it, because that's the allegory, that's her attribute, that her mouth is gagged. Like, you know, I don't know, the Allegory of Justice would have beholding scales, right? The Allegory of Painting should have her mouth covered. And Artemisia says, forget about it. That's not what I'm going to paint. You know, I do not want to be gagged by anybody. I love this little, you know, biographical tidbits. But at the same time, I'm just thinking, at the end, all I care about is what is the painting itself and
right,
and how amazing it is. But they would have had to struggle with so many obstacles, regardless of... I'll give you another example of a painter that maybe I will cover later on. Her name is Rosa Bonheur. She was...
I love her
painter.
Work.
She specialized in painting animals, and she was unapologetically lesbian in the mm-hmm. society that was not exactly conducive to that kind of lifestyle. And she was absolutely unapologetic about it, and she was living with the same partner for decades. And her road to art was that she didn't even bother painting people. She decided that she loves painting animals, and it's just like, I'm painting animals and I'm living my life the way I want to live it, and everything else be damned. I mean, the force of character of this lady must have been amazing. I'm just full of admiration how she found her path in the world that was neither accepting female painters or accepting the homosexual lifestyle. None of it stopped her from becoming an artist and being displayed and having commissions and participating in museum exhibitions. Nothing could stop her. I find it wonderful.
One of the recent books that I love from Dr. Farrell, he wrote a book called Microcosm and Medium. And one of the things he talks about is the debasement of popular culture, or the debasement of culture by a significant amount of money from sort of different interests in the U.S., pouring money into art, which is very either incoherent or debasing of the human. And all the women artists you've written about and the ones you pointed out to me or, you know, talked about are the opposite. They really humanize. And, you know, they really, I don't know, they celebrate the human capacity is the way I view their art. And they take you into the intimate world of, you know, especially of the children in a way that I love. So to me, it's almost an anecdote to that horrible, you know, I'll never forget. I was in a cab and I was going down Fifth Avenue and I passed the Rockefeller Center and there was a sculpture in front of Rockefeller Center. You know, they cycle them around, that was arguably the ugliest, most incoherent piece of modern art I'd ever seen in my life. And I picked up the phone and I called Joseph and I just couldn't stop laughing. I said, I had to call you because I am looking at the worst thing. You know, I'm looking at your worst nightmare and you haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to send you a picture. Anyway, but I think of your Women Artist series as an anecdote to the whatever that modern plague is.
Well, I think the painters that I was talking about have lived in kind of ages past, and everything is much different from like a second part of 20th century or post Second World War. So now, in the art world, in the economics of it, in the social aspects, there's a lot of factors. The fact that women are treated much more equally in art, that they can lead independent lives and they don't have to fight for their place in the society if they are talented that much, because it's just everything has changed. But I think you touched upon something that we probably should do another completely different podcast on, meaning what is art and what isn't, and how the the money world kind of skews the what is good art and what is bad, because when you throw a lot of money at anything that potentially has value, then obviously you end up with these hideous so-called artworks in modern art museums that I get, right. You know,
and the next thing you know, the next thing you know, the museum guard has to get you to not step on it because it's a work of art and you thought it was a sewer.
Yeah, you and I had this experience actually.
I know, I remember.
Wonderful Fondazione Prada, which is in Milan, which is a wonderful museum. We have seen actually pieces of art that were not art at all. The Fondazione Prada, right, is a wonderful architectural gem, and it's a very interesting space. But actually, the exhibition that we ran into at the time was the kind of, you know, modern art that really gives you nightmares, completely unnecessary. But that's for another podcast. For this one, we'll be kind of winding down. But I think there's a couple of conclusions here. One is that it is worth while, you know, looking at art or going through museums to kind of find women artists' works and drill down who are these people, why are they there, how what was their road to this, who is this artist. There are so few works by women in various museums that it's kind of sometimes fun to just uncover, oh, this is by actually female, you know, what did she do, how did she come to be exhibited in a museum. So that's one. The other one is to always kind of think about the socioeconomics or the political aspects of it, you know, how difficult it might have been, or maybe easier, I don't know, sometimes easier, but different to be a female artist in the profession, if you like, that is dominated by men, for no apparent reason, because both men and women can actually hold brush the same way. But I think the problem was the social economic aspect that you were talking about.
Right.
And the third one is that we'll try to write more about women artists so that just people could just see that there have been in history quite a lot of them, but they are maybe just less known.
But they're beautiful. They're beautiful. I'm always looking forward to what you come up with next.
I can so. Be.
Right, but it's also great stories because you always pick people who are very interesting. You know, the eye candy is fantastic, but the backstory is amazing. So,
well, backstories always interest me, male or female, because, you know, there's always something more than meets the eye. But then I always want to do a circle at the end and say, well, okay, now I know everything about this artist, but I still want to just look at art, just stand in front of a canvas or look at it at the screen and just look at it and say, like, why do I like it? What is so wonderful about it? even if I know nothing about the artist. So kind of do it in circles and have the experience.
You know, after we launched the Food for the Soul website, I sent it to the one of the people I most admire as a connoisseur of great culture. And she's just amazing in terms of what she's read, what she knows, what she's seen. Exceptionally well-educated and well-traveled. So this was the test. Had we done a good job? And she came back and she said, these columns are fantastic. I told her it was going to be great eye candy. She said, oh, I love the painting choices, but I feel like I'm getting an art lesson and a history lesson at the same time. And it's true. You do. You're very good at sort of drawing us into the history and the time, but we get a story about a person and they're all fascinating.
Well, this is very kind, thank you. But I just think that that's what we always want, especially as Food for the Soul, meaning stories, you know, amazing
right.
stories of people's lives or when we look at art, you know, what is behind this piece of art, you know, who did it, why was it done, what were the circumstances. Sometimes the story is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, they can say to you, no matter how bad the pandemic is, it could have been worse. You could have been a woman artist in the 17th century in Italy.
Well, it was actually during the plague as well for the poor Artemisia Gentileschi.
Yeah.
There's a suspicion that she actually succumbed to the 1657 plague that was in Naples that kind of wiped out a dozen major artists.
Wow.
That was in 1657, I think. There was a plague that came to Naples and... literally, a lot of them just succumbed that year. And there's a suspicion that that's what happened to her. We don't even know. But that would not be a very happy ending. So let's just circle back. All we want everybody is to enjoy the art, to look at it as art, regardless of what the story is behind it.
And and next time, we're going to be doing something on the documentaries for teenagers?
Yes, we had a wonderful subscriber request of him being cooped up with his family, which is the experience of millions upon millions of people right now. And wanted to have some suggestions of documentary films that would be appropriate for kids, meaning young people up to about, you know, teenagers. So
right.
We're going to take a look at a few that we think that might be inspirational or educational or just fun for young people to see.
Fantastic.
That's our next story.
Okay, Nina Hein. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Catherine. Till the next one. Thank you.
Food for the Soul. Enjoy.